This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the creator and showrunner of the ABC sitcom Black-ish, Kenya Barris. Michelle Obama has said Black-ish is her favorite show. Its second season concludes tonight with an homage to the 70s sitcom Good Times. Black-ish is about a 40-ish husband and father, Andre, who goes by the name Dre. He grew up in the inner city, but is now an advertising executive living in a predominantly white suburb with his biracial wife, who's a doctor, and their four children. In the pilot, he's promoted to vice president of the urban division, which leads him to think he's become the token black executive. He's afraid his children are becoming too assimilated. Dre's son is also named Andre, but his white friends call him Andy, which sounds all wrong to Dre. The son has joined the field hockey team, and that doesn't sound black at all to his father. And the son has a lot of Jewish friends, and he wants a big bar mitzvah party, like his friends who are having one. So he's considering converting and changing his name to Shlomo or Shmuel. So the father, played by Anthony Anderson, decides it's time to draw the line and call a family meeting.
All right, listen up. I may have to be urban at work, but I'm still going to need my family to be black. Not black-ish, what? But black. So we're going to start with some strict guidelines.
So then he sent me a smiley face with a wink. I mean, I should be offended, right?
Zoe!
I'll text you.
All right. From here to forth, we are going to keep it real. So, Junior, if I hear anybody calling you Shlomo or Shmuel or especially Andy, I'm going to back you over and whoever else is saying it in my car.
Dad.
Quiet! I may have to watch you play possibly the dumbest sport in the world, but I do not have to sit back and listen to you rave about other kids' bar mitzvahs. So, next Saturday, when you turn 13, you're becoming a man too. A black man, because I'm throwing you an African rites of passage ceremony. Ha!
That does not sound as fun.
No, it does not.
Okay, I have an idea. Why don't we take a black break and go get some white yogurt?
Yay!
That's a scene from the first episode of Black-ish. Kenya Barris, welcome to Fresh Air. How'd you come up with the premise for the series?
I came up with the premise by living a day in my life with my kids. I was laughing listening to that because it so reminds me of a moment I would have had with my kids. And it really was based on my family. You know, my wife she's an anesthesiologist. She's mixed. My kids are growing up in a different situation than
but
I
mixed,
grew up in.
You mean she's black and white. Yeah, she has a white parent and a black parent. Yeah.
Her dad's white and her mom is black. Mm-hmm. And we came from a different situation than our kids. And me and my wife are both from different situations. And we're raising our kids up. Me in particular, my kids are nothing like I remember, quote unquote, black kids being when I was a kid. So I'm sort of trying to navigate what that's going to be for me. You know, you're taught to give your kids more, but in giving them more, like, what do they lose? And I think that sort of was the conceit and premise of the show.
So you changed class when you were a child, in a way, because there was this sudden influx of money. Do you want to explain what happened?
A couple of things happened. My father lost a lung in a chemical accident at General Motors, and after a while, he got a settlement that sort of changed all of our lives and moved us from what we, you know, say ashy to classy in some aspects. At the same time, my mother had gotten her real estate license, and, you know, she was really, really entrepreneurial and started selling real estate, and her life sort of changed around that same time. And we basically, my sister and brother had started going to, you know, had gotten into college and went going to USC, and it was all of a sudden we sort of went from one segment of the socioeconomic ladder, and we sort of went up a rung, and it was a, you know, around the time for me where I was just old enough to kind of see really both sides, and it really influenced who I am.
So did you change neighborhoods?
I did. We changed neighborhoods. We changed schools.
Compare the before and after.
Ashy to classy. you know, it's interesting. I feel like when you live in a lower economic neighborhood, one of the things that's really really endearing about that is that you really don't know it until you're not in it, because there's something really sort of unifying to everyone is sort of broke, you know. And it's not until you sort of go to different schools and things like that that you're able to look back and be like, wow, we were really broke. But you know, there's a unifying, you know, presence that everyone wants to get out of that situation and you're kind of, you know, together in a struggle to sort of have more. But it's not until you have a little bit more that you really realize how little that you had. You know, for me, one of the things that I sort of worry about with my kids is that they will not have that sort of context to sort of understand what their life is and what it could be.
In your show Black-ish, it's as if the children are growing up in a different country than the parents did because of technology, you know, because of like social media and cell phones, and also because of class, and because they don't think as much about race, because race isn't separating them from mainstream culture in America the way it did for the parents, or at least for the father. And therefore, things that mean so much to the father, like witnessing the inauguration of the first Black president, don't mean that much to the kids because it's all they know. So they just take it for granted, like that's the way it is.
There was a moment in the pilot that we put where Jack didn't know that Obama was the first Black president. And that really happened to me in my life. We actually were walking through the Atlanta airport when the inauguration was going on, and people were crying and this and that, and my son didn't quite understand, you know, what was happening. We had to explain, like, it's the first time the first Black president. And he's like, he's the first Black president? Years later, we had the conversation when he's a little bit older, and he's like, we're like, you really remember that he was the first Black president? That's why those people were crying. He was like, oh, I forgot about that. And I'm like, how could you forget about that? And we realized that's the only president he's ever known. You know, and for him, a president is Black. And there's something sort of really nice about that. And there's also something sort of, for who I am, a little scary, because I want him to know how big of an accomplishment that is, and how, you know, for the country, not just for our people, just for the country. And I don't know if he gets the context.
The father in Black-ish is concerned that his kids are picking up white norms and that they don't have, like, a Black cultural context the way he did. And, like, in the clip that we just heard, examples are that, you know, the father's name is Andre. He calls himself Dre. His son is Andre. But the kids at school are calling him Andy. His white friends are calling him Andy. And the father just, like, hates that. And the son wants to get, you know, bar mitzvahed so he can have a lavish party like he sees his Jewish friends having. Then the father decides, well, you're going to have a Black rites of passage ceremony. You're going to have, you know, an African rites of passage ceremony. And that seems very righteous to the father and very boring and pointless to the son. And it just made me wonder if there were in your family generational differences on Afrocentricity.
Absolutely. You know, actually, that particular story was an aggregate of Lawrence Fishburne, Anthony Anderson, and myself. Anthony Anderson actually has the copyright to the word bro mitzvah.
Because that's really great, yeah.
Because his son, you know, who was the only, as he calls him, the only little chocolate drop in his class, Anthony's from Compton, but, you know, he's been working in the entertainment industry for 20 some odd years and had some successes. And so his family were, you know, his kids in particular came up in a different situation. His son came in, and I remember this when I started going to the schools. I remember that 12, 13, 14-year-old point where you're just going week to week to week to bar mitzvahs. And his son was doing that, and we don't have that in our culture. You know, it's like there's money, there's bands, and there's groups, and there's part. It's like, why can't we have this? And so his son came in and was like, I want a bar mitzvah. And it really freaked Anthony out, and he said, I want a bro mitzvah. And Lauren said there was a time like that with his child, and he gave his kids an African white rites of passage ceremony, and I remember getting that. But I remember, you know, Lauren was telling me about it, I remember thinking how not fun it was. My generation, I believe, was the first generation to really benefit directly from the civil rights movement. My mom, you know, went through civil rights. My dad went through civil rights. My name was Kenya because they wanted to give me an African name. And subsequently, my generation sort of took more of a, because we didn't really have, you know, foot to pavement or rubber to road type of marches and things like that. We took more of an intellectual sort of revolutionary approach. There was Public Enemy and, you know, the Malcolm X, you know, Autobiography for Malcolm X exploded. You know, there was the Malcolm X movie. There was Spike Lee. We sort of became more of philosophical revolutionaries. And now my kids and their generation, one of the moments I remember when I was pitching the show that really sparked for me is the Trayvon Martin incident happened. And my daughter, you know, came in and I was like, you know, how do you feel about this? And she was like, you know, we're really upset. And she's like, every kids I know are protesting. And I'm like, oh, that's awesome. Like, what are you doing? And she said, you know, look, we're doing it on Instagram. And she shows me this Instagram picture, and it's just a Black frame. It's like the picture, it's just an all black thing. And I'm like, I'm like, okay, so where's the protest? She's like, this is it. Look how many people are putting black on their Instagram. And I realized that this must be the most low rent protest I've ever seen in my life. I was like, I can't get like a small trash can fire. Like, I don't know, like anything. Like, and it really showed me the generational difference. And, you know, I think that that is one of the reasons I did an episode this year called Hope, where the family at the end, there was an incident, the family decides to go down to the protest. And we really try to make sure we end our shows not on saying any one way to be is the right way to be. But I wanted in this particular episode to say, I do think that something that we have to do as a people is, you know, and not just as a black people, I mean, as a country, is really actually be more proactive. No matter what we do, I think that that is something that digital age kind of takes away from us. You know what I'm saying? We feel like we can sign online protests and do that. But I think we have to actually put rubber to road, foot to pavement, and be more proactive.
Let's talk about that episode called Hope. This is the family figuring out how to answer questions that are unanswerable, questions from their children. So everybody is around the TV watching as the news is about to come down about whether a police officer accused of misconduct is going to be indicted or not. And what he's accused of is tasering 37 times a black man who was selling DVDs. And so, you know, they're watching, there's protesters kind of surrounding the site, and the family's watching this on TV, and it comes down that this officer is not going to be indicted, and then protests really break out. There's reports of fires and looting, and you know, the children are wondering, like, especially the young 6-year-old is wondering, like, why is everybody so mad? So the parents are trying to explain to them, and then they get into a kind of debate about the police and the justice system, and the mother is kind of defending some faith in the justice system, like the children have to learn how to, like, be polite to the cops because ultimately the justice system works. And the father and grandfather are very skeptical of that idea. And she says, well, I don't want my kids to grow up in an environment where there's no hope. So this is a conversation between the father, Anthony Anderson, who plays Dre, and his wife, Rainbow, who's played by Tracy Ellis Ross.
Don't you get it, Bo? The system is rigged against us.
Maybe it is, Dre. But I don't want to feel like my kids are living in a world that is so flawed that they can't have any hope.
Oh, so you want to talk about hope, Bo? Obama ran on hope. Remember when he got elected? And we felt like maybe, just maybe, we got out of that bad place and made it to a good place. That the whole country was really ready to turn the corner. You remember that amazing feeling we had during the inauguration? I was sitting right next to you. And we were so proud. And we saw him get out of that limo and walk alongside of it and wave to that crowd. Tell me you weren't terrified when you saw that. Tell me you weren't worried that someone was going to snatch that hope away from us like they always do. That is the real world, Bo. And our children need to know that that's the world that they live in.
So that's a scene from Black-ish, and that was Anthony Anderson that we heard. And my guest is the creator and showrunner of Black-ish, Kenya Barris. So you kind of spoke the unspeakable in that, because I think there's so many people who have been so worried for, was it 7 years now, that, you know, that somebody would do something to President Obama, you know, and I don't even want to say the word. And it's like you were directly addressing that fear in that, in addition to kind of getting to the injustice of the justice system.
I mean, it's so weird. I kind of like am getting choked up a little bit. Like, hearing that on the radio, it's different than seeing it on television. The words are a little bit more piercing. Wow. Anthony did a really, really good job. And I think, yes, we, you know, I had no idea when I was writing. I was terrified when I was writing that, because I was like, this is not what the show is. It's a comedy. I was struggling during the writing process to sort of make sure keeping the tone. Ultimately, that episode, although it's really kind of, you know, taken on a life of its own, was not at its inception about police brutality. You know, we feel like it was something that was a really good sort of lens to sort of focus our cameras on, but it really started from the conceit and the inception of the idea was that we're living in this world right now. You know, there's terrorist act, there's racism, there's brutality, there's sexism, there's, you know, we're in a really, you know, tumultuous political moment right now. And I feel like there's so many things that your kids cannot be tuned out from because of 24-hour news, TMZ, the internet, you know, other kids, you know, whatever. They can't sort of, the one time ability to sort of turn off the outside world and just kind of raise our kids is gone. So it really was like, how do you have conversations with your kids about things that you're not necessarily wanting to have conversations with them about? And how do you have those conversations and not let your past experiences sort of scorch the earth of what their future is going to be? And we took the idea of police brutality because we felt like it was something so organic to what we're going through right now and what this family would be going through. And it actually really that particular moment actually really happened with me. And so I really wanted to tell that conversation. And I think that moment of television for me is probably the most special thing I'll ever be involved in. I just don't think as a comedy writer you get to be involved in things like that. And you never know it's going to happen. It kind of sort of happened on its own. But it was a sort of cathartic week for everybody involved.
So let me ask you about a story that you have not, to my knowledge, used on Black-ish.
Okay.
And this is a story from your own life. Your father was abusive. Your mother left him mm-hmm. with the children. She took the children and left him. One night, I'm not sure how old you were, he broke into the house. Mm-hmm. And she had a gun and shot and wounded him. And I think mm-hmm. you were watching while it happened. She told you to call the police. You did. What went through your mind when you witnessed that?
I mean, I don't, you know, it was I think probably like, oh, shit. Like, you know, like it kind of was like.
How old were you?
I probably was 5 or 6. It all happened so fast. I think I knew pretty quickly that he was going to be okay. You know, he went away on his own, you know, feet. And shortly after that, we saw him in the hospital, you know. So I think I pretty quickly knew that he was going to be okay. I think I was really more so worried about my mom, you know, to see her not in her, you know, normal. My mom was not a crier. My mom was not, you know, she was a very, very strong lady. And to see her sort of not composed, you know, it was something I was not used to. So I think that was one of the bigger things. I feel like, maybe as I'm saying this, I'm like, wow, I'm a sociopath. I think part of it was kind of fun. I know that sounds crazy, but it was like the police came and they came and showed me I showed them my room and I was like, you know, I heard a gun go off. And I don't think at that time you're thinking necessarily, you know, you saw the person walk out, they're going to be okay. It kind of was just like, oh, this is sort of maybe an exciting moment. And, like, you know, I was talking to my mom about this, and she was trying to talk to me about, like, my recollection and opposed to hers. I mean, it was such a, I think, sort of, like, cyclone that it hit me. And I think that's the beauty of being young, is that you're malleable, and you can sort of bend, and but at the same time, you bounce back really well.
You know, a really strange twist to this is that the father who your mother had left, who then broke into the house really angry, he'd been abusive, she shot him. Later, and you can tell us how many years later, he had that industrial accident that ended in the loss of a lung, and it was the settlement money from the subsequent lawsuit that helped fund your mother's ability to move you to a better neighborhood and better schools.
It's so interesting you say. I didn't even look at it like that. And I think that's one of the things that those, my, you know, upbringing and, you know, seeing my mom and seeing my dad, who's, you know, for all whatever, you know, things he has been through, you know, he went through troubles in his marriage like everyone does. My dad was a really good dad. I never was a time where my dad was absent in my life. He just wasn't there, you know, living with me and my mom. And I chose, you know, I think a lot of kids doing divorce, I chose my mom, you know. But, like, you know, I always could get my dad if I knew him. You know, I think that sort of that moment changed my dad for the good part. He has a special needs kid that I've never seen someone take more interest in. You know, I feel like it made my mom became like a, you know, she was Joan of Arc after that. Like, she really...
After she shot him, she was Joan of Arc?
Absolutely. She was a force to be reckoned with, and she went on and became very, very successful on her own, and, you know, and when got, you know, took money and things that came in her life and did really well with them. And to this day, if I have financial issues, I'll go to my mom almost before I go to my business manager.
So one of the episodes this season was about the N-word. And can you say it? Who's allowed to say it? Who decides who's allowed to say it? And the premise of this episode is that the six-year-old son was performing at a school talent show. And for his performance, he was doing Kanye's Gold Digger and using the N-word in all the ways, in all the places that Kanye does on the recording. And the school punishes him because they have a zero tolerance policy on hate speech. And the parents are really upset, you know, thinking like, who are these people to tell us if we can use the N-word? But there's even a fight within the family between the father and the mother about whether it's okay for their son to be using it in that context on the talent show. So let's hear a little bit of this dispute between the father and mother about the N-word. And I should just say before we hear this clip that every time you hear a little music, it's a little flashback scene in which we hear the person who's denying that they ever use the N-word actually having used it.
Damn it, it's his birthright. Jewish kids get to go to Israel. Black kids get to say this.
Trey, that is ridiculous. Nobody should say it. It is an ugly, hateful word with an even uglier and hate-filled history.
Yeah, of it being said to us, not by us.
As usual, son, you have absolutely no idea what you're talking about.
But
that is not a word that black folks need to be using, ever.
No.
You see, I never used it.
What?
You act like these lights around here gonna pay for themselves. Well, I only said it to separate myself from the rest of you people.
Mm-hmm. Unlike Earl, I really never say it.
What?
Watch it. Saying it to your dad is trifling behind, don't count.
Oh, agreed. All we're saying is, of course, every now and then it slips out, but it's never said casually and never in mixed company.
Exactly. It's only a judgment said with disdainful indictment.
Pops, you and Mom's generation used the word for self-hate. You made it negative. My generation, we reclaimed it, and we use it as a term of colloquialism and power. Same way the slaves took the leftover pig guts and found them plants growing in the woods and turned it into chitlins and collard greens. That's what we did with the N-word.
Yeah, here you come with that chitlin argument.
You believe this?
Mom.
Okay, so that was a scene from Black-ish, and we heard Anthony Anderson and Tracy Ellis Ross as the parents, and Larry Fishburne and Jennifer Lewis as the grandparents, and my guest Kenya Barris is the creator and showrunner of Black-ish. So how do you think of the word? Do you think of it as a word that, like, your generation reclaimed, and it's okay for some people but not others to use it, which is the argument that Anthony Anderson makes in this?
Well, I'm usually going to side on Dre's side, because Dre... is sort of based upon me and, you know, Anthony. And, but yes, I think that the word is, it's interesting. I think that it is one of the most divisive, densely discoursed, just polarizing words in American history. And I feel like, you know, words as a writer, I believe that words are powerful. But I do believe that words also, in having anything that has power, means it has growth. And in having growth, it can evolve. And I think that that word has evolved, you know, and has, you know, generational differences for different people. For me, in my particular way that I look at it, and I think the character Dre, you know, came out to say, is that I feel like the word, you know, obviously there's the ER and the AH and, you know, the things that go along with the word. But I feel like, in general, to not get into that specific of it, I feel like the word is sort of a tribal badge. You know, I do look at it for myself. You know, my generation looked at it as something that we took the disdainful indictment that my mom's generation would use it in, because it was of how it was said to the generations before her. We took that away from it, and we made it sort of a, you know, a badge of tribalism between, sort of to say, between two members of that tribe, to say, look, I know that you're a part of this tribe, and we have some shared heritage, whether I know you or not. I think that I go back and forth, because as an artist, I also feel that, you know, that episode came up because I found out that my daughter was using it with friends who were not black, you know, and it had just become a colloquial word of coolness. and she didn't really like the, you know, so it, I think, you know, I go back and forth. I think the rappers have put it in songs, you know, for mass marketed consumption, that it's sort of hard to tell white kids they can't say words of that for in songs that they buy. It's like buying a book, selling a book, but telling certain segments of the society they can't read certain pages of the book. So I go back and forth because I do believe that art needs to be able to be expressed purely, but I, you know, I have a battle with it.
So every time the word is used on that episode, and the episode is all about that word, it's bleeped, which is usually what happens on network TV and on often on basic cable as well. And we go back and forth on our show about whether we should let somebody use it or not, uncovered, or whether we should bleep it when they say it.
Who wanted to use it? I'm very interested. Who said, hey?
Okay, most recently, Jerrod Carmichael used it because we were talking about the Carmichael Show's episode with that, because they did a show about whether it's okay or not to say it, and he's used the word in his comedy, and we actually were playing a sketch in which he was playing some of his stand-up in which he quotes somebody as using it. And so I asked him, well, should we bleep that or not? And he explained why he didn't think we should bleep it. And we actually left it unbleeped, although at times we do bleep it. But did you have a big discussion with ABC, with the executives there, about whether they should bleep the N-word or not? Notice I'm not going to say the word.
You know, it's crazy. Before I answer that question, it's saying the N-word makes it almost more, you know what I'm saying? Saying it makes it almost louder when you say the N-word. Like, I feel like one of the most interesting conversations that happened with ABC was around this episode. In an amazing, amazing way, they were going to let us say it. They were going to let us see how many we could say. You know, there was a debate. Like, we had, like, literally, I call it a negotiation or N-word negotiation because it was, like, literally, like, I'll give you two N-words for, you know. And what we ended up doing, and I'm so glad that, you know, my partner Jonathan Groff is always sort of comes from the scientific method way of dealing with things. Like, we went and did an experiment, and there's nothing like being around a group of white people and just saying, you know, when two dudes are just saying it, and you just see them just cringing and, you know, tensing up or whatever. And, you know, we felt that, just like I told you, I think the N-word almost makes, saying the N-word makes it even louder. We felt that beeping it, we played it with and without, and we felt that without the bleep limited our access points, limited our entry points for comedic accessibility. You know, we felt like you were going to be so sort of cringed every time the word was said that you were not going to be able to really hear it. And honestly, the beep made it even louder and funnier because you knew what was being said. You're saying it in your head, but it allows for you to comedically fall into the story, you know? So it came from a really sort of thought out place.
So the resolution on the episode of Black-ish about the N-word ends with the father basically saying to the young son who wanted to say the word and did use the word when he was doing a rap at the talent show, the resolution is, wait until you're old enough to understand the history of that word and the meanings of that word, and then decide if you want to use it. I thought that was an interesting resolution. Of course, children don't always follow what their parents tell them. So who knows how that would actually play out in reality. But I thought it was a very, you know, a very interesting resolution. Is that what you tell your kids?
You know, it's interesting. That word, at my kids go to one of those sort of, you know, private schools that zero tolerance on any of those types of things. And a kid got in trouble for saying it. It wasn't my son. And I was bothered by the fact that kid got in trouble for saying it. And I understood that he shouldn't have said it in mixed company and those type of things. But I feel like, you know, I'll notice my son, or it actually happened with my daughter. We were listening to a rap song and the word came on. And I was like, hold on, did you not just say the word? I was like, no, let's rewind this. You can get that off. Go ahead, you can say that. Say it again. And she wasn't comfortable saying it. And I was like, no, you've got to say it. It's your. And I realized that the PC structures have gotten to her where she felt like it wasn't hers to say either. And I'm like, no, it is yours to say if you choose to say it. You know what I'm saying? You cannot let the powers that be take away your right. Now, you need to know the history of why people are saying that you should not say it. And you need to hear the other side of people who feel like you can say it. And then you can make your own, you know, decision. But I want you to understand that from your dad's point of view, if you choose to say it and it's not in a, you know, boorish, you know, way. You can say it, and that's why I said not in mixed company, but it is your earned history. So many little things that we have in this country we can say are ours. You know, we have had so much stuff taken from us, language and culture and history, and I feel like that was something that we took back the power on. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And I feel like, so it was something I was very passionate about. I was like, one of the reasons when we started talking about that story, I was like, I have to write this.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Kenya Barris. He's the creator and showrunner of the ABC sitcom Black-ish. The season finale is tonight, and the season finale is an unusual episode in that it's an homage to the 70s sitcom Good Times. And the premise is that the father, Dre, has he's worried about paying expenses over the summer because his kids want to go to camp, and his wife wants to take some time off from work because she's pregnant. And he's just seeing these like expenses mounting up. And so he has a big meal, watches a Good Times marathon on TV, and falls asleep and dreams that he's a character in Good Times. And so it's this kind of homage to the series. What did that series mean to you?
I caught the whole series. I caught it in reruns. But that series, and more importantly, Norman Lear, mm-hmm. who, I'm unbelievably blessed to be able to call a friend. I am what I am as a writer because of Norman Lear and Spike Lee. And Norman Lear in particular. And I feel like, you know, Norman had this amazing ability to sort of have the foresight to talk about real things at a time when they needed to be talked about. And for some reason, television went through this amazing sort of hibernation of not talking about things. That family in particular affected me, and it affected my family, and it affected other families that didn't look like my family. And it really, you know, showed that at the core, you know, rich or poor, family is about love and about sticking together. And I think that that was one of those specific universalities that really sort of influenced and informed what my show does. You know, and, you know, I'm writing the Good Times movie for Sony, and I think I'm a derivative of Norman Lear. So that, you know, the idea to be able to show that and do that with my show was a dream come true. And at the same time, huge fan of the fashion, huge fan of the, of the music, of the time period in general. And I think my cast had a really good time with it.
You're a huge fan of the fashion because you don't have to wear those clothes for real.
maybe. I mean, but I would have loved to have had, you know, literally a situation where I could just let my hair grow as long as I could and not be considered, you know, not ultimately rebellious. Like that was, you know, black people were walking around with afros, and they were walking around with, you know, they had, my sister showed me a hairstyle called a Sweet Jesus, which was a big afro, and you would take and put a part down the middle, and there was just something just so, it was peacocking in an amazing way.
Don't tell me you're yearning for those enormous collars.
I may not be, you know, but Tom Ford, who is my favorite designer, does a wink wink that $700 says he sort of sees something good in it. I feel like there were some really bad choices, you know what I'm saying? But at the same time, I feel like high-waisted pants that end in bell bottoms. Mm-hmm. How often are we seeing some of our biggest designers do a variation on that now, on those colors? And mm-hmm. there was just a ceremonial nature to some of those clothes, especially for black culture,
right,
that I really feel like. And you, please, like, you know, email me. Look how amazing the cast looks tonight when you see them in some of those clothes. Tracee Ellis Ross in particular just looks amazing. And I feel like for women in particular, there was a celebration of the female figure in a way that was not as gratuitous as I'm seeing it being done now. And it actually really did lend itself more to fashion and less to just sort of a salacious nature of exploitation that I'm seeing, you know, clothes do now.
Interesting. Okay. So in the New Yorker profile that Emily Nussbaum recently wrote about you, you described how when you were a kid, and I don't know how old you were, mm-hmm. during a period when you were, you know, getting into trouble sometimes and stuff, that you would approach white women at gas stations and ask them if you could pump their gas. Now, I am one of the white women who's been approached by kids at gas stations asking if they could pump my gas. And I thought it might be interesting if we compared notes about what that experience was like for each of us. Do you want to start, or should I?
You know what's crazy? Two things. I know where your notes are going to go. And I did not realize that that was the notes until I was an adult. You know what I'm saying? And I look back, and not only did I realize I was terrifying these white women, into, I was basically strong-arming them into giving me a dollar to do something they could easily do. But I also was panhandling. And I did not see it. You know what I'm saying? I feel like it's part of, like, you know, ghetto games. I feel like you do certain things. I was so proud of myself for being entrepreneurial and not being going and selling drugs and doing this, but I was basically being a little strong arm panhandler who was preying on people's, you know, sympathies and at the same time their fear. So I can. What are your notes? Let me hear your notes.
My notes are that there was something inherently patronizing or condescending or insulting about a kid coming up to me assuming I needed help pumping my gas. Like I do it all the time. Like I can do that myself. Do I look like not strong enough to like handle the gas pump? You know? And then I'm thinking like, well, what is the bargain that you are trying to make with me? What's being unsaid here? How much money do you expect from me? Is it a dollar? Is it $5? Is it $10? If I say yes, oh, please help me pump my gas, and I give you a dollar, you're gonna look at me like, hey, that's not enough. You know, like what's all the subtext here?
So, I think the subtext was, what does it cost for you to keep me off the street and not take your wallet later? What is that worth to you? Is that worth a dollar? That's fine. I'm okay with that. This negotiation really works out well. You know, I didn't think of the feminist approach that you were saying in terms of like, I can't. That's the first time I've ever actually heard that. I thought of the idea of maybe I was sort of preying on your white liberal guilt that, you know what I'm saying, like, oh, these kids are trying and, you know what I'm saying, and to do something and I'm going to do this. I thought I was very aware of that part of it, you know, that I was sort of playing on the liberal, like, part of people feeling sorry for me. I wasn't aware till later that it sort of had a little bit of a strong arming, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, the idea of like, are they afraid of taking out their wallet? I don't think I thought about that. And the one that hit me most recently is that I was a bum. I was panhandling. I was basically on the side of the road with a sign. And I was really upset at myself. But to be completely fair, we could have been doing something else worse. And
That is the subtext, yes.
That is the subtext. And I think that was the understanding.
But did you ever, like, if a woman said, no, thank you, then what?
We were fine. I mean, there were many times that we would say, Kim, we'll do it for you for free. You know what I'm saying? Many times. I mean, probably half the time we would say, you know, a lady would say, I don't have this or whatever. And we're like, we'll do it for you anyway.
So one of the new developments on your show, Black-ish, is that the wife and mother, who's also a doctor on the show, is pregnant. And she's probably, she already has four kids, and she's probably, what, in her early 40s?
Mm-hmm.
And you're 40. Mm-hmm. 40, okay. And your wife is pregnant now. Mm-hmm. And she's probably roughly the same age as the character on the show, I'm guessing.
39.
Okay.
39,
And so do you plan on working in a lot of her pregnancy and the birth of your new child into episodes next season?
Absolutely. We don't want it to be...
Nothing goes to waste.
No, yes. We don't want it to be... Exactly. I'm living this life so that I can monetize it. And I think that we want it to speak to the notion that women are having babies later. You know, women are having babies while they have really big careers. Men are having to sort of take different roles in that. You know, there is so much stuff with, you know, fertility and things like that. I feel like we wanted to sort of talk about some of those stories and some of those things that go on. You know, my wife was told she had a geriatric womb.
Oh, that's on the show too. Yeah.
Yes.
It sounds so horrible, a geriatric uterus.
It sounds
uterus.
Awful.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if men went into the doctor and they're like, you have a geriatric penis? Like, they would come up with a different way to say that very quickly.
Yeah. You know, it's definitely true.
And it was very interesting that was sort of, you know, something that was told to her with a straight face. And, you know, I want to talk about, I've had so many friends going through fertility issues and just the notion of having a later in life child and, you know, while at the same time maybe having issues with your, you know, finances. And I think that there is really rich layering and texture to these stories.
Well, I'll be looking to see how it turns out on the series and in your life. So one more thing, because Black-ish is a network, sitcom, you have to do, what, 24 episodes a season? While on cable, it's more like maybe 8, maybe 10. How, I mean, at this point, I feel like, how can you possibly do so many episodes? Because, you know, I'm so used to cable where the season is just, like, so much shorter.
You know, I just saw that Gerard got, who's a friend who I'm a fan of, and he happens to be my friend. He just got picked up for his third season. Congrats, Gerard. But they're doing 13. Mm. And I was like, God, I wish I could do 13. Mm-hmm. You know, because I do feel like it's a real testament to my writing staff, you know, and to my actors. There is a weight that is put on your shoulders when you know that you have to do that from an acting standpoint, from a producing standpoint, from a writing standpoint. I feel like the thing that we've been really able to do is not become formulaic in terms of letting the stories feel stale. And I think the best way to do that, this is a Phil Rosenthal trick, you know, you get people who've kind of living the life in terms of having a family, having stories to tell. He said that he would walk in on Everybody Loves Raymond. Phil Rosenthal ran Everybody Loves Raymond. And on Monday morning, he'd say, so what happened over the weekend? And so that's a really big, you know, notion for us. And we, you know, one of the things I've learned as a showrunner that I really try to take into my room is listening. A lot of times we're so involved and so invested in ourselves as showrunners in terms of being the voice of the show that we aren't able to listen. I think that my job is to sort of hear what's going on, you know, and sort of take that and turn it around into something. There was a story where someone saw two guys kissing. A guy saw two guys kissing on the way to the bus stop on his way to work. And it bummed him out. Like, you know, am I homophobic? You know, and then that started a conversation. And I was just like, you know, well, do you think you are? And then we know. And the same time, we all came to the conclusion that if you saw a guy and a girl really going at it, it would sort of like freak you out. And really what it came down to is he was just like, no, I just don't like massly, grossly, you know, large displays of public affection. He was like, and it sort of starts the conversation about like, what is homophobia? And that's, so I feel like there are ways to sort of come up with stories, and we're trying to sort of make those really conversational.
Well, Kenya Barris, it's been great talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kenya Barris is the creator and showrunner of the ABC sitcom Black-ish. The season 2 finale is tonight. On Saturday, Black-ish will be honored with a Peabody Award at their annual awards ceremony. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, the Panama Papers, millions of internal documents leaked from a Panama law firm that specialized in creating shell companies to help the rich and powerful, including politicians, hide their wealth. Our guest will be Kevin Hall, chief economics reporter for McClatchy Newspapers, who researched the documents. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a song by singer-songwriter Guy Clark, who died yesterday at the age of 74. Clark was inducted into the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame. His songs were recorded by Johnny Cash, Lyle Lovett, Rodney Crowell, Willie Nelson, and Emmylou Harris. He was part of a circle of songwriters closely connected with Texas that included Townes Van Zandt and Jerry Jeff Walker. This is one of his best-known songs, L.A. Freeway.
Pack up all your dishes, make note of all good wishes, and say goodbye to the landlord for me. Some bitches always bored me. Throw out them L.A. papers and that moldy bags of vanilla wafers. Adios to all this concrete. Gonna get me some dirt road back street. I can just get off of this L.A. freeway without getting killed a car. Be down a road in a cloud of smoke to some land I ain't bought, and it's his to you, old skinny Dennis. The only one I think I will miss. I can hear that old bass singing, sweet and low like a gift you're bringing. Play it for me one more time now. Got to give it all we can now. I believe everything you're saying.